All right, let's get into this. You've given us excerpts from Scaling and Renormalization in Statistical Physics by John Carty,
Okay.
a book that really explores the crazy world of phase transitions, like water turning into ice or a magnet suddenly just losing its magnetic properties.
Yeah, it's interesting how those everyday occurrences represent huge shifts in matter, all driven by the interactions of just tons and tons of these tiny particles.
It's like one of those massive flocks of birds all moving together. I mean, individually, they're just flapping their wings, but somehow together, they're creating these like mesmerizing large-scale patterns.
Totally. And what's really fascinating is that even with how complex these systems are, there are these underlying mathematical principles that can help us understand them. And this book really dives into some of those principles, specifically scaling and renormalization.
Okay, so scaling and renormalization, those sound pretty technical. Can you break those down for us?
Sure. So think about it like this. Imagine you're looking at a forest, but you're looking at it from a distance. So you can see the overall, the shape, the density of the trees, but you can't see each individual leaf.
Right, you're getting the big picture.
Exactly. And scaling is all about understanding how a system's properties change as you zoom in or out, as you change your scale of observation. And what's really interesting is that, near phase transitions, these systems often have this property called scale invariance.
Scale invariance, does that mean they look the same at different scales?
Yeah, you got it. It's like those fractal patterns you see where you can zoom in forever and you keep seeing the same structure repeating itself. And near a phase transition, the system kind of behaves in a similar way. It exhibits these same patterns, whether you're looking at the individual particles or at these large groups of them.
Wow, that's pretty mind-blowing. So where does renormalization come in?
So renormalization is kind of the mathematical tool that we can use to analyze this scale invariance. It's a way to systematically average out the little details at the smaller scale so we can see the big picture.
So instead of getting lost in all the tiny little details of each particle's interactions, we can kind of group them up and look at how they behave together.
Exactly. And by doing that, we can actually uncover the underlying mathematical relationships that govern the system's behavior right near that phase transition.
And the book refers to those relationships in terms of power laws, right?
Yeah, power laws are basically mathematical expressions that describe how one quantity changes in relation to another and near phase transitions. These power laws often have these kind of unusual exponents, which basically means that the relationships aren't those simple linear ones that we're used to seeing.
Can you give us an example of what that looks like in a real system?
Sure. So let's take the specific heat of a material, which is basically a measure of how much energy it takes to raise its temperature. Normally, the specific heat changes gradually as you heat things up, but near a phase transition, like when water boils, the specific heat can suddenly just skyrocket.
So, like a tiny change in temperature near the boiling point can lead to this huge change in the amount of energy needed.
Exactly. And that really dramatic change is actually described by power law with one of these non-integer exponents. And these exponents are called critical exponents, and they're kind of like fingerprints that characterize the specific type of phase transition.
So these critical exponents, they give us insights into what's happening at the transition itself.
Yeah, they tell us how sensitive the system is to those changes near what we call the critical point. So, for example, there's an exponent that describes how the magnetization of a material, basically how strong a magnet it is, how that changes as you get closer and closer to the temperature where it loses its magnetism.
And it's kind of remarkable, I'm starting to get this from the book, is that these critical exponents can be the same even for systems that seem totally unrelated.
Yeah, that's the idea of universality, which is one of the key takeaways from all this. It means that systems that are as different as, say, a boiling liquid and a demagnetizing metal, they can actually exhibit the same kind of behavior near their critical points.
It's like there's some kind of secret code behind these totally unrelated phenomena. So if we figure out the critical exponents for one system, does that mean we can use that knowledge for other systems too?
Yeah, absolutely. This universality, it's a really powerful concept because it allows us to draw these connections between different areas of physics and even, areas beyond physics.
Okay, I'm starting to see how all of this is connected. So we've got these phase transitions, which have this unusual behavior that's described by these power laws. And then these power laws have these critical exponents, which act like fingerprints. They reveal what kind of transition it is. And they even connect different systems through this idea of universality.
Exactly, you're getting it. And the cool thing is that we can actually use the renormalization group, this mathematical tool we talked about earlier. We can use that to calculate these critical exponents and then predict how systems will behave near those phase transitions.
It's pretty amazing how this like abstract mathematical tool can help us figure out all these real-world phenomena. But I'm also wondering about the limitations. Does the renormalization group always give us perfect answers?
That's a great question, and it kind of leads into another important concept called mean field theory. It's a simpler way to try and understand these phase transitions, but it often doesn't quite get it right, especially near that critical point.
Mean field theory, I vaguely remember that from my physics classes, it had something to do with like averaging out the interactions, right?
Yeah, I mean, field theory basically assumes that each particle is only interacting with this like average field that's created by all the other particles and kind of ignores those little individual fluctuations and deviations from the average, which actually turn out to be really important near that critical point.
So it's like trying to understand a flock of birds by assuming they're all flying in perfect formation and ignoring that they're constantly adjusting and reacting to each other.
That's a great analogy. And because mean field theory kind of oversimplifies things, it often doesn't predict the right critical exponents. So that's where that renormalization group comes in. Again, it gives us a more sophisticated way to account for all those fluctuations and get more accurate results.
So if we really want to understand those critical exponents, we need to move beyond mean field theory and use the renormalization group.
Yeah, exactly. It's a more powerful tool that lets us really capture how complex these systems are and get a deeper understanding of how they behave near those critical points, you know, those tipping points.
This is all fascinating, but I have to admit, I'm still a little fuzzy on how this renormalization group actually works in practice.
Well, the good news is that the book gives us some really concrete examples using what we call the Ising model, which is kind of a simplified way to represent a magnetic material. It shows how we can actually apply the renormalization group step by step to really analyze how the system behaves.
Can you walk us through those steps without getting too bogged down in the equations? I'm really curious to see how all of this plays out in a real example.
Sure. So imagine we have this lattice, like a grid, where each point represents a tiny magnet that can point either up or down.
So we've got this lattice with all these tiny magnets, and each one can point up or down. What does the renormalization group actually do with that?
So it basically involves grouping those magnets together into these larger blocks, like you're creating bigger pixels from those smaller ones in an image. And then we try to determine the effective interaction between those blocks. So we're kind of simplifying the system, but we're still trying to keep those key features.
So we're kind of like zooming out to get a more coarse-grained picture of the whole thing.
Exactly. And by doing this over and over again, we can actually see how the behavior of the system changes as we move from that really tiny level of individual magnets to a more macroscopic description.
And this is how we find those fixed points, right? The special points that describe how the system behaves near that phase transition.
Right. Those fixed points are basically the points where the system looks the same even after we've applied that renormalization group transformation. So it really reflects that scale invariance we were talking about earlier.
So by analyzing those fixed points, we can understand how the system's going to behave at that critical point, right, where it's about to change from one phase to another.
Exactly. And, you know, the book doesn't just talk about magnets. It uses these ideas to look at phase transitions in all sorts of systems, mm-hmm. even some really exotic ones.
Like what? Give us some examples.
Well, it goes into things like polymers, those long chain like molecules, you know, that make up plastics and DNA. And it even gets into surface critical phenomena.
Surface critical phenomena. That sounds interesting. What's that all about?
So think about a material where the behavior at the surface is different from how it behaves like deep inside the bulk of the material, like how water molecules act differently at the surface of a lake than the ones in the middle.
Right, because the surface molecules have fewer neighbors to interact with.
Exactly. And near a phase transition, these surface effects can become really important. And the book actually uses the renormalization group to analyze how those surface properties change as we get closer to that critical point.
So it seems like this idea of scaling and looking at things at these different levels, it keeps popping up everywhere in these complex systems. But I'm wondering, does the renormalization group always give us exact answers? Are there limitations to this approach?
Yeah, that's a really important point. And the book actually addresses this by talking about a technique called the epsilon expansion.
Epsilon expansion, that sounds a little bit like something out of Star Trek.
Well, it might sound a bit sci-fi, but it's a really powerful mathematical tool. It's basically treating the difference between the system's dimension and a special dimension called the upper critical dimension as a small parameter. And we call that epsilon.
So instead of trying to solve the problem perfectly, we're doing kind of an approximation using this small parameter.
That's the idea. And surprisingly, this approach can give us really accurate results even when epsilon isn't super small.
The book uses this epsilon expansion to look at the Ising model near four dimensions. Why four dimensions? What's so special about that?
So four dimensions happens to be what we call the upper critical dimension for the Ising model. With those short-range interactions above this dimension, things get a lot simpler because mean field theory actually becomes exact.
So by working near four dimensions, we're kind of starting from a place where we already understand how things behave, and then we can use the epsilon expansion to see how things change as we move down to those lower dimensions where fluctuations become more important.
Yeah, exactly. It's a really clever way to capture those deviations from mean field theory and get better predictions for those critical exponents.
And the book compares these predictions to other methods, right? Like exact results or even computer simulations.
Yeah, and it's pretty remarkable how well the epsilon expansion works, even at those lower orders. It really shows how powerful this technique is.
But it's not just about getting the numbers right. It seems like the epsilon expansion also helps us understand the theory behind it all too, right?
Absolutely. It actually reveals how important these mathematical objects called operators are, which basically represent physical quantities like energy density or magnetization.
And some of these operators are more important than others when we're talking about this critical behavior, right?
Yeah, the book mentions relevant, irrelevant, and marginal operators. And those classifications basically tell us how an operator's influence grows or shrinks as we get closer to that critical point.
So it's like some operators are really pushing the system towards the phase transition while others are just kind of along for the ride.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. And figuring out which operators are the relevant ones, that's crucial for determining what's called the universality class of the phase transition, which basically means which systems are going to share those same critical exponents.
So by understanding which operators are really in charge, we can actually predict how a whole bunch of different systems will behave near those critical points, even if they seem totally different at first glance.
Exactly. It's like uncovering this hidden code that connects all these seemingly unrelated things.
This is starting to feel really powerful. We've gone from watching water boil to talking about these abstract mathematical things that govern how matter behaves at this really fundamental level.
And we've just scratched the surface of what this book has to offer. It goes on to talk about even more specific topics like those logarithmic corrections, cubic symmetry breaking, and even the world of low-dimensional systems.
Low-dimensional systems, like what are we talking about, Flatland here?
Not exactly, but it does get into systems that are confined to one or two dimensions where those effects of fluctuations are even more intense.
I remember from my physics classes that things can get really weird in those lower dimensions. Can you give us a taste of what the book says about these unusual systems?
Sure. So it talks about something called the two-dimensional XY model, which describes a system of spins that can point in any direction in a plane.
So instead of those up-or-down magnets in the Ising model, we've now got these tiny compasses that can point anywhere on a circle.
Exactly. And what's really interesting about this model is that it shows us this special type of phase transition called the Kosterlitz-Thulis transition.
Kosterlitz-Thulis, that definitely sounds like something I wouldn't want to try to say after a few drinks. What makes this transition so special?
Well, unlike those typical phase transitions where the order parameter, you know, that thing that tells us the difference between the two phases changes, suddenly the Kosterlitz-Thulis transition involves this gradual change in a different quantity called the correlation length.
Correlation length, that's the measure of how far apart particles need to be before they stop affecting each other, right? So in this weird transition, the influence of those particles gradually fades away instead of just disappearing all of a sudden.
Exactly. And that leads to some really unusual behavior, including a power law decay of correlations with an exponent that depends on the temperature.
It's amazing how, even though we're just looking at this one book, these ideas of scaling and renormalization, they have these huge implications.
You're absolutely right. These concepts have been applied in all sorts of fields like cosmology, materials, science, and even finance. It seems like everywhere we look, we find these same principles at work governing how complex systems behave.
It really is mind-blowing how these ideas from physics, these concepts of scaling and renormalization, can be used in so many different fields.
Yeah, it's like there's this universal language of complexity.
Yeah.
You know, a way to understand how these systems behave near those points where even a small change can cause a big shift.
And what's really interesting to me about this book is that it's not just about the math. It's like it's giving us this new way to look at the world. You know, it's encouraging us to think about those hidden connections between things that seem completely different.
Yeah, it's about being able to see both the forest and the trees, you know, understanding how things work at one level and how that relates to how they work at another level.
And being able to recognize those tipping points where a system can suddenly change from one state to another.
Exactly like with those social networks we were talking about. I mean, a single tweet, something that seems so insignificant, can sometimes set off this huge chain reaction that spreads through the whole network.
Or in the financial markets, you know, a small change in how investors are feeling can trigger this like cascade of buying or selling, and that can lead to a boom or a bust.
It really makes you think about how these critical points are everywhere. You know, They're shaping things in ways we don't even realize.
So how can we use what we've learned from this book, these ideas of scaling and renormalization, to understand and maybe even predict these complex systems better?
Well, I think it starts with realizing that even the most complicated systems can often be broken down into simpler parts that interact with each other based on certain rules.
And by looking at those interactions, you know, how they change at different scales, we can start to see those patterns emerge, those critical points where the system becomes super sensitive to even tiny changes.
It's like looking for the cracks in a dam. You know, those weak spots where a small leak can quickly turn into this major disaster.
So it's not just about understanding the individual pieces of the system, but also how they're connected, how they interact and influence each other at different scales.
Right. And that's where the power of the renormalization group really comes in. It lets us analyze those interactions and pinpoint those critical points where the system's behavior can change so drastically.
It's like we're zooming out to get that big picture view, but we can still zoom in to see the little details.
And by doing that, we can start to understand the complexity all around us, you know, from how matter behaves to the dynamics of societies and economies.
Well, as we wrap up this deep dive, I'm left with the sense of awe at how interconnected everything is. You know, how these ideas from physics can help us understand so much about the world beyond just the lab.
And hopefully it sparks some curiosity too, You know, a desire to keep exploring and asking questions about those hidden patterns and critical points that shape our lives.
Because at the end of the day, that's what this deep dive has been all about, not just giving you information, but inspiring a sense of wonder and a thirst for a deeper understanding.
For yeah, who knows, maybe the next big discovery will come from someone who takes these ideas and uses them in a completely new area.
So keep your eyes open, stay curious, and never underestimate the power of a good question. You never know where it might take you.